I'm Ruthie, host of Out There, here on Valley Free Radio. Tune in for stories from the streets and paths of Northampton and beyond, Fridays from 4 to 5 p.m. Get out if you can, but if you can't get out, tune in. We don't care if we live out of date. We don't care if we're a little bit late. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. And for today's show, I'm going to play some recorded interviews from a trip to Chicago. Oh, but first, I got to notice that it's raining. Hallelujah. It's been dry, huh? And before today's rain, I was riding around town. Such a frenzy of leaf blowing. Leaf blowers, electric leaf blowers, gas-powered leaf blowers, leaf suckers in the backs of pickup trucks sucking up piles of leaves. Lots of people with those blowers. Actually, I saw someone on the bike path last week behind my house who was blowing leaves, riding this road bike with a leaf blower sticking out, holding the gas-powered leaf blower and blowing leaves to the side of the path as he was riding down the block of the bike path, then riding up the other block, blowing them off. And I saw a guy in East Hampton doing the same thing. He had an electric blower, the guy in East Hampton. And the guy in East Hampton had a rake. Rakes. Does anyone use rakes anymore? Whatever happened to the rake? I don't think I saw a single rake out there today. I don't know. Is there a big rush? Whatever happened to living? All right, that's enough rant for now. Let's see. You know, because I got confused about my intro here, I didn't play my normal intro music, so I'm just confused. Okay, today's Veterans Day, November 11th, Friday, November 11th, 2022. Thanks for tuning in today. And let me just cut to a clip. So, all right, I'm talking about this. So today's show is just going to be all these clips from my trip in October. So I went on the train to Chicago, and then I took the bus to Kentucky. And these clips, I think, may go from as far as the train, Amtrak, as far as to Lima, Ohio, where I had a bus transfer. People that you'll hear in Chicago are, you'll hear from Tim Herlihy and Maria Barnes, who, they were instrumental in the beginnings of Pedal People. I used to live in Chicago. 1993 to 2002. Yes, you'll hear about that at some point. And let's just go. It's Saturday, October 1st, 2022. I'm on the train to Chicago, speaking very quietly because I'm surrounded by 31 Amish people. I don't want them to see me on my device. Anyway, so the train, yeah, I got on in Springfield yesterday afternoon. And the man sat down next to me. He was coming from the Big E. He'd spent the last 2 days at the Big E, and he was headed back home to Albany. We got to chit-chatting, and then we got to telling jokes and like pencil and paper jokes. Anyway, we laughed and carried on for a while. He gave me the other half of his ginger ale, offered me his rum too, but I passed on that. And he taught me how to make a trumpet noise out of a straw stirrer by sucking in on your straw stirrer. When the train passed through Pittsfield, when the train stopped in Pittsfield, I looked out and sitting on the curb, I saw a person, the one person, I'm pretty sure it's the one person I know in Pittsfield, who was sitting there waiting for the train. I was hoping she would get on the same train, but well, apparently she was waiting for the eastbound. There's one train a day in the eastbound that goes through Pittsfield, and one train a day westbound, the Chicago to Boston line, the Lakeshore Limited line, and apparently they cross in Pittsfield about the same time of day. So she was waiting for the other one. But, so I didn't get to talk to her, but I sent her energy waves, thoughts through the window. In Albany Rensselaer, we waited for an hour or so for the train to come up from New York City to join for people that are going like New York to Chicago. So I had an hour to walk around, and Alex, my housemates Alex and Sarah, had told me about a mulberry tree near the train station, which when they were through in June, they said had amazing mulberries.
So even though it was the 30th of September yesterday, I went walking around looking for the mulberry tree. And I found a tree, a mulberry tree, that looked like it would be promising in June. And I found, less than half a mile from the train station, I found this row of apple trees. Like medium height, semi-dwarf apple trees between a like industrial parking lot and some other parking lot, restaurant, bar parking lot. And those apple trees, oh my gosh, they were laden with apples. There was more apples than there were trees. And on the ground was a carpet of apples. So I filled my bag. Now I'll have apples to give to my friends in Chicago. At some point early on in the ride, when there weren't very many people on the train, there were these three guys, a couple seats behind me, three unrelated guys, I think, that were just connecting on the train. And they were saying things like, "Oh, I want to take the train from Seattle to Alaska." And the other guy said, "Oh, well, you have to take the Canada rail if you're going to go through Canada." And the guy said, "Oh, I can't get into Canada. They won't let me in because of my DUI record." And one of them said, "Other countries telling the United States what to do." Oh, and they seemed really serious when they said that. And saying things like, "Oh, Chicago is really growing. Yeah, growing in crime. Oh yeah, the youth there, they just assault police officers." And then they were going on about professional sports. Oh yeah, these were three middle-aged white guys. And one of them said, "The other day, someone called me a redneck." And I said, I took that as a compliment. I said, "I am a redneck. I'm a Northeast redneck." Well, their voices were kind of loud, and they were sort of setting the tone of the part of the car that I was in. So I moved up a seat. I was kind of too far away to like engage without it being like I was going out of my way to... I mean, not that I would have picked a fight. I probably would have just, maybe engaged a little bit, but I feel like I might have got overrun. Anyway, so then I moved up a seat in the car. And it was really fascinating when more people got on the train. They toned it down a bunch, and just like the whole tone changed. That whole strength in numbers one way or the other thing. To eat, I've had a bag of chips, a small bag of chips and an apple that Mark gave me when he spontaneously, unexpectedly popped in at my house and gave me a ride during his lunch break yesterday and gave me a ride back to Plaskett Park. I had to be there for a 2 o'clock B48 and he had to be back at work at 2. That was super convenient. And then now met me. I took the B48 to Holyoke. And there's a 10-minute layover there between the B48 and the B21 Express. And now met me there from her work and gave me an apple and a cookie and a letter. And then when I was on the train, my seatmate that I was joking around with, he gave me half of his ginger ale because he said he didn't want to pour it down the drain. Oh yeah, and I found a couple of sugar packets on the floor. Haven't eaten those yet. Don't know when I'll eat them, but they'll be good for something. And then there's the apples I found in Albany, and I've given a few of those away on the train, and the Amish couple sitting beside me gave me some of their chocolate chip cookies. And I've got nuts and raisins and pears, aka Asian pears, from Paige. Oranges that I found in some compost the day before I left, and a chocolate bar from Berta's Peruvian Chocolate Farm. And that's someone who lives in Northampton who invited me to dinner last week. It was funny being on the train with all the Amish people as we were going through northern Indiana. Well, mostly I think they were talking in German, but as we were going through northern Indiana and they were looking out the window and I heard people like pointing and saying things very excitedly, and they were spotting other Amish families and homes along the railroad tracks. And I was like, "How can you tell?" And they said, "Well, the horses and the carriages and the tin or the metal siding on the houses. Plus the houses are usually kind of big because we often have big families. And then also laundry on the line often could be an indicator." I was thinking about how I would squeal if I looked out the train window and saw a cyclist with a trailer behind. My people, my people. The Amish community that's on the train today is from Wisconsin. They went to New York for a wedding, and now they're headed back home to Wisconsin. Well, one more thing about food on Amtrak is, or a drink, is that every car has a water dispenser, so you can refill your water bottle again and again and again. Now the loud I'm a damn Yankee redneck guy is telling the Amish people that, are you from near Green Bay? You're in Packers country. The Amish couple I'm sitting across from said they operate a sawmill in Wisconsin where people bring in logs and they cut them up for wood for pallets and ship them out. And the commentator says, ooh, we're going through a bad neighborhood now. Going through Gary. Oh, look at all the graffiti. Oh, this is a bad neighborhood. You wouldn't want to get off here. My other seatmates are playing Uno, playing Dutch Blitz, playing some Bible card memory game, playing some Tetris kind of game, reading, writing, napping, talking, looking out the window and waving to the other Amtrak train that pulled up alongside of us. We're coming into Chicago now.
Are you afraid of it?
Not my friend, but...
Well, I went back and talked with him for a little bit. Probably mostly just for distraction, to shift the energy than anything. So, give him some time to talk with me instead of just bad mouth on the neighborhood. Well, he's back at it. You couldn't pay me to walk out of this train right now. You'd get shot. He's not even from here. When I lived here for 9 years, I biked all over this place. When I asked him if he was afraid, or what he was afraid of or something, he said, well, I'm white. And then I said, well, I just don't feel like focusing on the negative parts of a neighborhood and talking about that, highlighting that from the window of a train. Like, I think it just makes more people afraid and just increases hostilities and fear among groups. And then I asked him a bunch of stuff about his life. His trip, his travels, whatever he wanted to talk about.
I came outside of Union Station in Chicago and unlocked a divvy bike, and I was getting on it with all kinds of people milling out outside Union Station, and a group of black men, young black men, walked by, and I overheard one of them say, there are too many white people. And then overheard another one say, are you scared?
Yeah, I would be. I met up in Humboldt Park with some old friends from Chicago, and I'm sitting here in the grass while they went to go buy CDs. Oh, the band is just warming up, this band. But anyway, I'm sitting here in the grass, and the people on trash and recycling duty, they just rearranged where the trash and recycling cans are, and they put them about 8 feet from me, and they were like kind of tentative, and they asked me, they're like, are you okay with these trash cans so close? I said, I'm a trash hauler. They said, oh, you're the perfect person. It's October 1st here in Humboldt Park, Chicago. It's the World Music Festival, and I ran into some old friends who I knew from my Catholic worker days. All right, you can introduce yourself.
My name is Seth Tristan Jensen.
Seth, you were telling me that you're living in an intentional community. Where? What? How?
The community is called Perennial. It's a housing cooperative started about 5 years ago by some folks who were living cooperatively but had a vision of a more solid, lower turnover group living situation. So they made it happen, essentially, acquired a property, recruited people to live there, and gave it the name Perennial because they really wanted to be deeply rooted. And this all took place in Madison, Wisconsin.
I'm unclear. Like, can you tell me how you make intentional community intentionally more long-term? Because I feel like a lot of communities want to do that, but how does this community do anything different to make that happen?
I think that it really just goes back to that being a core value of the founders when they started it, and they put that out there over and over and over again when they were setting up the cooperative. And also, I guess, there really is a strong commitment to actually putting cooperation into practice, which people might have different understandings of what that means, but I think there's at least a shared commitment to having it be not just a cooperative in name, but in actuality.
I imagine the screening process or getting to know you process, like, how long, what is that like?
It's actually, so in my community, a bit of background, a bit of context. In Madison, there's actually a number of cooperatives, a number of housing cooperatives where people live together in a shared environment and actually own and run the place together. So it doesn't differ that much from the screening processes of all the other cooperatives in town. Prospective members, and we don't have openings very often, but when we do, prospective members are asked to come for a few informal visits, usually during a house dinner, and then there's a formal interview and a meeting among the existing members of the household to decide who will be the lucky one who gets admitted.
Who owns it?
So this is getting into kind of like some legalese, but technically the owner of the Perennial Cooperative is the Perennial Nonprofit Organization. That's the ownership entity. I mention that because these sorts of things are important when setting up an intentional community is having some kind of legal ownership entity rather than just a bunch of names on a housing deed, which can be problematic.
That's what we have at my house.
Okay.
Anyway.
Yeah, so a good example. In the big community world, there are no huge, hard, and fast rules. Definitely nothing that I would say will never, ever work. But there are certain risks involved in certain types of ownership entities. So we're owned by a nonprofit organization, but the nonprofit organization's membership is essentially everyone who lives at the household. So when you become a member and move in, then you become a part of this legal owner entity organization.
Thanks for sharing. Yeah, Pedal People wants to do something like this because the cost of housing is so much, has gone up so much, and it's hard for people to do Pedal People as a job and make the kind of income you can make as a part-time bicycle-hauling trash hauler and still pay rent in Northampton. So thinking about different models of home ownership to make it affordable is important.
It is, and I will say that especially with the economic problems and issues that have arisen over the last few years, that's a significant benefit of living in this, or pretty much any other housing cooperative in Madison, is how the rent is way below the average of your average housing cooperative. And your average housing cooperative, when you pay rent, you're actually paying like some grocery bills, you're usually paying for electricity, you're paying for a lot in the rent.
Awesome. Anything else you want to say?
I guess I would just like reiterate that point that the housing cooperative is really a cushion against the, in many ways, a cushion against the, well, what I would say is the savages and ravages of capitalism. Not just in terms of like cost of living and saving money, but in the kind of isolation that our system breeds. Certainly not a cure-all, but it's significant when you're sharing your day-to-day life with other people and not being so atomized as we're kind of like forced into by our current housing setup.
Hey, this is so great to see you here, Seth.
Great to see you too, Rufy. Chance to get on my little soapbox and box.
Wait, actually, can you say that all over again? Because I didn't.
Rufy, it's so good to see you too. I really appreciate the opportunity to be asked to get on my soapbox and talk about things that I really love to talk about and have a lot of passion for.
I hope the background music is a pleasure and not an annoyance to listeners. This is Gina Brass Band from Chicago, EDS/Chicago. Gina Brass Band, Chicago. J-I-N-A. I haven't seen you or your bike in many years, Lucky, but you have the same sign on your bike that you had like 25 years ago.
Yeah.
What does it say?
It's either from 2000, I think it's from 2003. It could have been 2001. It says bicycling, a quiet statement against oil wars. And then at the bottom, real small, it says committee for full enjoyment.
What's it mean to you?
It means that most of my life, this chunk of it, but even going before that, before the sign existed, and it is plastic. It's made out of a petrochemical. I got it from Tim Herlihy. And it's just, you know, it's still relevant, and it'll be relevant for my time here on this earth.
There's a place along the North River in Chicago where there's a multi-use path paved, and then for this stretch where it's wood chip path and prairie grasses and wildflowers. So comforting for the human foot and soul.
You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. I thought there was another interview with my friend Lucky that was coming up, but I must have somehow missed it. This is WXOJLP 103.3 FM in Northampton. And Out There airs every Friday from 4 until 5. And I play clips and thoughts and rants and things from my week or my travels of people I meet around town or around the larger universe. Today's show is from Chicago. And you just heard from Seth Tristan Jensen, a former housemate of mine when I was living at the Catholic Worker in the 90s, who now lives at Perennial Cooperative in Madison, Wisconsin. It was just happenstance, sort of, mostly, that we happened to meet in the park there. Well, happenstance and lucky Marla Witz is organizing. So this next series of clips from my trip are... Oh, that music that they just went to after the brass band. That music was actually church music from a Catholic church that I went to with Dorothy Day's granddaughter, Martha Hennessy. That was happenstance, too. I showed up at the Catholic Worker in Uptown that Sunday morning, and a couple people, including her, were going to church, and I said, why not? So I went to Mass. Then after that, well, I'll just play the clip. So
yeah,
it's Sunday.
Story hour.
It's Sunday. Is it Sunday? It's Sunday, October 2nd, 2022.
October 2nd.
I'm in Jackie's.
Yeah, this is the 2nd.
I'm in Jackie's backyard. And here in Uptown with Tim and Maria. Maria.
And Lily.
And Lily the dog. I know Tim and Maria from my Catholic Worker days when I lived in Uptown at the Catholic Worker at St. Francis House in Uptown. Maria has a bike shop. Maria, what's the name of the bike shop?
Uptown Bikes.
Which was started by Tim, yes?
Urban Bikes was the predecessor of Uptown Bikes, yes.
UptownBikes.org. That's all you need to know.
So, Tim, I was living at the Catholic Worker, I think, when you started Uptown Bikes. And
Just started. 1993.
Yes. Yeah, what was your... Can you say anything about your vision for the shop at that time? What kind of shop you wanted it to be?
It started actually in the garage of the Catholic Worker House, where, Zeke and I would... Well, Zeke was fixing up bikes, but Zeke was... He was God and man in one person, and it was hard for him to relate to the community. I had better skills in relating, for example, selling the bikes that he would fix. And I said, we'll lock him up on the front. And he hit a throne in the basement of the Catholic Worker House that was just like all his collection of bikes. And he was a little challenging because God and man was challenging. But we ended up like tying up bikes on the outside of the lock him up to the fence in front. Yeah. And then put a price on them, and people would buy them, and we split the money, and he'd go buy tobacco and some whiskey, I think, and I would, whatever, I reinvested. So, eventually I got a storefront and a kitty corner from the Catholic Worker House, mm-hmm. And then took some of the kids who would come to the backyard of the worker, and they were part of the shop, and it was like a live-in shop. It was tiny, like about 400 square feet or so. A teeny tiny shop, and Maria's like living there. We were living there at first, but okay.
And no, we were in the loft.
In the loft, yeah. We built a loft in the back, and it was great. I mean, it was the beginning. Like, it was a good place.
And then we got busted by the housing department.
Yeah. For living in the shop.
For living in a shop and having a little stove.
And then they busted all our neighbors. Like, it was a three-story building filled with Vietnamese and Cambodian immigrants, and they every single apartment had a commercial sewing machine in because they were doing commercial sewing. And they all got busted for having commercial and residential, and we got busted for having residential and commercial.
Those were the days.
And then, so it's grown. It's been really successful, yeah?
Relatively, yes.
Well, I mean, I don't mean to equate growth with success. Can I suck those words back out of the air and down into my throat?
It's very for-profit oriented now.
It was a little more anarchistic in the urban bikes days. It was a little more horizontally organized, and it was a barter thing. Like, the kids that were working there oftentimes would work for dumpster pizzas. Uh-huh. Like, we would go out dumpster diving because we would actually dumpster dive our stuff. We'd go up to the suburbs and find bikes and inner tubes and pull them out of the dumpsters and bring them back and patch them. And
when Peter Klein was working there and he was living at the Catholic Worker and he was working at Uptown Bikes, he's the one that taught me how to dumpster dive bike tires. I remember being behind a bike shop in the suburb once. He pulls these bike tires out and he's like,
first you got to check the sidewalls. Then you got to check the treads. Make sure the bead's not damaged.
Yeah, that's especially good to do it on site because you can put the bad ones back in the dumpster and take the potential ones to the shop and then reuse them. Yeah, no, life is good.
There's a lot that goes into dumpster diving. It's not just like, you know, willy nilly. You grab what you can get. You gotta really find the quality stuff.
Like that hammock that we just brought down the alley this morning.
That's right. Thank you, Ruthie.
The hammock and the frame that we rolled down the alley.
Yes, exactly. And the Rubbermaid tub. High quality.
Wish I was in Northampton, or it would have fit on a Pedal People trailer. This is all the Uptown Bikes transition. It will transition at some point in the story to how it ties into Pedal People.
Yeah.
But first, tell me how it transitioned from Tim to Maria.
That was in 2004, and Maria was working, that's me, was working as an architect. And then I... also hated working as an architect, so I was just plotting my my escape. So anyway, Tim decided to retire, and because like the anarchism wasn't really working anymore,
and like financially,
yeah. And so then we also decided to like have official employees that were on a payroll and so forth. So we ended up. Like transferring, basically Tim abandoned the shop and I found it and I took over, and then we incorporated and became Uptown Bikes in 2004, and that's how it is. Yeah.
And also it's the bike shop without any dudes.
No dudes. sorry dudes. There's other shops that you can go to, you can apply to. You can come to the shop. We welcome all dudes, non-dudes, and, you know, everybody else to buy stuff and have their bikes worked on. But as far as employment, we pretty much, like, currently are women-led. Mm-hmm. So there's me, Leah, who is the shop manager, who has been at the shop. This is her finishing up her 7th season. And then Nina, some of you in the listening audience might know her. She is a UMass alum, and I think she worked at the bike co-op there. Oh. Yeah.
You know her last name?
Nina Hazelton.
Hey.
And she, so Nina is our senior mechanic. And there's a few other people who are like seasonal employees in the summer. But yeah, pretty much women-led and staffed. Yes. No more dumpster diving, though.
Do people dumpster dive behind your shop?
No, they don't dumpster dive behind our shop. But yeah, we decided a long time ago to go the route of sourcing everything from this supply distributors, and now this like supply chain is really kicking us in the butt, but we'll make it work.
Well, so for me and the Northampton listening audience and how it ties into Pedal People, like when people ask, well, how did you start Pedal People, or how'd you get the idea? And I'm like, well, back when I was living at the Catholic Worker in Chicago, we did community meals where we collected food donations, and we didn't have a car, and so we would borrow a friend's truck for the food run to go get donations from Whole Foods or Trader Joe's.
That was a friend.
And at one point, Beth's truck broke down, and I was like, well, I'll just tie the garden cart to the back of my bike and go pick up the food. So
wow.
I did that. It was like 4 miles down to Whole Foods or wherever. And
legend.
It was a little
4 miles.
Yeah, it was a little awkward, the garden cart in the back of my bike. It worked, you know, well enough, but a little awkward. And Tim, my friend Tim, who had this bike shop a couple blocks away, he was like, hey, Ruthie, I got a better idea for you and the Catholic Worker. And so he donated this Bikes at Work trailer to the Catholic Worker. And that was how I got introduced to Bikes at Work trailers. An 8-foot-long Bikes at Work trailer.
That's what you guys use now?
Yeah.
Wow.
So that was my introduction to hauling things on trailer with a bike.
Yeah, and that was a long haul. It was not a short haul. You had to go through the steel yards. like the steel recycling plant to get like there.
Fibronet and stuff. Yeah.
That was legend. I mean, really legendary. And then I think I helped you out. And a couple, you can get the inside dumpster at the Whole Foods. Oh. Like when somebody's inside picking up the produce.
Oh, yes. You show me that. Yeah.
You could kind of walk. There'd be two people. Like one person would be really nice to the nice inside Whole Foods people, but somebody else would be crawling in their compactor and loping off the nice oranges.
Like a distractor?
Yeah. It was always good to actually, usually it was oftentimes the non-male would go in and be the one to distract. And then there'd be, it was a couple other places, like Treasure Island, the same thing. You'd have, like, it was a perfect closed dumpster, which meant there wasn't a lot of competition. All the homeless people weren't hauling there. So you had the inside, and you could just pull out the really high-quality cheeses and the special bags, like having a good eye for what bags had the cheeses in them and stuff. Those were the days of dumpster diving, yes.
High class.
Where was the Slytherin dumpster? I forgot where that one was.
Up in the suburbs.
Oh, yeah.
And they would start locking up dumpsters. You know, and you had to slither into them.
Oh, yeah.
And then somebody would go in and then hand out the stuff until...
What about that chocolate factory dumpster? Were you the one that brought home that 20, that third, that 30 gallon...
The big 5 gallon buckets?
There's like a 30 gallon barrel of chocolate.
Damn.
Chocolate.
There were the 5 gallon ones, which I don't think.
It Carrie was a big block. Yeah, I remember this big
Carrie
block.
Carrie was on the route.
We were like chipping away at it. This is a good story about Ruthie. I remember one summer day. It was very, very hot, and somebody, I think the worker got like Catholic worker got like a big donation of milk, like whole milk, and. Like, what should we do with all this milk? It was too much milk to put in the fridge. So we got these big pickle jars, and you and I, Ruthie, spent the whole day shaking this
cream. Heavy cream.
And we made a big pickle jar full of butter. Yeah. And I had never done it before. But basically,
we were
like...
Say buttermilk.
No, no. Well, there was buttermilk on the...
Right.
But we were like...
You keep shaking it.
We just shook it. That was hard.
With an entire pickle jar.
It was an entire pickle jar, and we were just like shaking it, and then we would like pass it off. But it took a long time. But butter was made.
Without a churn.
Without a churn.
This is modern day butter making with a nice tight fitting lid on a glass jar.
All right.
And Sunday afternoons at 3, that's 3 o'clock Frisbee time. 4 o'clock, what time is the real time?
4 o'clock is when we start together.
Where?
Origo Park in Chicago in the Taylor Street neighborhood. It's a game that's been going for more than 30 years. It's kind of an ongoing community of long timers and people who pass through once and people like Ruthie who played for years and then passed through now and then.
Yeah, I told Justin, his name, I told him that I started playing in 1993, and he said, that's when I was born.
Yeah, and one joy is that we have multiple generations out here. We've got two players out here who like didn't exist when the game started, but their parents played, and now they're here.
How long have you been playing, Mark?
It's been 26 years now.
What keeps you coming back?
Yeah, it's, all right, now that could be a really long answer that your listeners may not want. So the short answer, fresh air, exercise, friends, a longer answer would be like a primary community for me. It's always been a very supportive, friendly group with like an off-the-field community as well. And then there's a... another answer that's that this is like my biggest experience of Sabbath. I did a sermon on it once. This is a time where for a couple of hours, no commerce happens, no work takes place, no electronics are involved. We are within a confined distance. I'm pretty sure.
5:48.
I'm pretty sure. Pretty sure this fulfills a lot of the traditional understandings of Sabbath in the Jewish tradition, and in our world in Chicago here, that's pretty important to find something like that. So that's what this has been for me.
I hope it's okay. I turned on my electronic device to capture that.
Sure. Yeah. <All right. laughs> Yeah. They have their uses out here, taking pictures, something like this. Sure.
Thanks for sharing, Mark.
Sure.
That was an interview with Mark Walden, a friend of mine, longtime friend of mine from Chicago. You're listening to Out There. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. This is WXOJ Valley Free Radio. You can hear archived editions of Out There at weatherbeard.com/out there. I think there's coming up on maybe about 250 episodes from when I first started the show. I have some more clips from Chicago, but first, since a bunch of the previous speakers, before Mark, there was Tim Herlihy and Maria Barnes talking about the bike shop in Uptown Chicago. But there was a lot of references to the Catholic Worker movement, and St. Francis House in Uptown. A little bit about the Catholic Worker movement. It began on May 1st, 1933, when a journalist named Dorothy Day and a philosopher named Peter Morin teamed up to publish and distribute a newspaper called The Catholic Worker. This is out of New York City. This radical paper promoted the biblical promise of justice and mercy. Grounded in a firm belief in the God-given dignity of every human person, their movement was committed to nonviolence, voluntary poverty, and the works of mercy as a way of life. It wasn't long before Dorothy and Peter were putting their beliefs into action, opening a house of hospitality, where the homeless, the hungry, and the forsaken would always be welcome. Over many decades, the movement has protested injustice, war, and violence of all forms. Today, there are some 228 Catholic worker communities in the United States and in countries around the world. And a little more specifically about St. Francis House in Uptown. St. Francis House is a house of hospitality in the tradition of the Catholic worker movement, which values communal living with people experiencing poverty and homelessness, as well as nonviolent resistance to war, injustice, and materialism. St. Francis House is located in Uptown Chicago. Our community has been practicing hospitality since 1974 by taking in single adults who need a place to stay. The house is supported entirely by personal donations and earnings. We receive no government, church, or corporate funding. Decisions are made by a group of people called workers who share the responsibilities of managing the house and are committed to the Catholic worker movement's ideals. All are welcome here. So that was a house where I lived I moved in 1993 when I was 19 years old. I quit college after my sophomore year. Born and raised in Eastern Kentucky, Northeast Tennessee, and went to college in Southwest Virginia for a couple years, all the same region. And then like my sophomore year of college, what really happened was I went to college. It was this small liberal Methodist college called Emory, liberal arts college called Emory and Henry. A good college, very good college. And I went there a very good Christian. And my first semester, I was taking New Testament religion as required by the college. And I had this Methodist professor that was teaching it. And as I was learning about the history of the Bible and the history of Christianity and in the context of other religions and stuff. Wow, when I learned how the Bible was written, I was like, oh, now I get it, why it doesn't all make sense to me, because it was all made up. And that was how I felt there at age 17. And then I lost my religion, I quit believing, I lost God as my best friend. God had always been there with me, with a purpose for me and for my life, my whole life. And then suddenly that was gone. So I struggled to recreate my sense of purpose. And also within the next like year or two of my life there at that college, it just seemed like most of my classmates were there so they could graduate, get a job, get married, have kids, buy a car, buy a house. And not one single thing of those on that list did I want. So during my sophomore year, another thing that happened in my sophomore year, I ran cross country in college and I played basketball on the basketball team. But halfway through the basketball season, even though I was doing very well statistically, I quit the team. Quitting the basketball team was something I thought about for a lot of my 8 years playing basketball between the ages of 10 and 18. But I finally did it this time because in college, I calculated I was spending about 4 hours a day on average devoted to this sport, whether it was practicing or traveling to away games or games, whatever, it averaged out to be like 4 hours a day. And I thought, I was also becoming a lot more politically aware. And I thought, if I am going to be spending 4 hours a day doing something, it either better be really fun or really good for the world. And I couldn't see that my being on the basketball team was doing either at that time. Oh yeah, another critical part of my journey was my professor, Steve Fisher, who I had for political science and for women's studies at Emory and Henry. He opened my eyes to a lot of injustices in the world and hearing people's stories. There's an interview with him on the archives of Out There, because I reconnected with him back in May when I went south and visited him and interviewed him. So that's on the archives, the weatherbeard.com/outthereArchives from the a May show. Anyway, all these changes in my life, and I just felt like I had to quit college because I didn't know why I was there. So I moved into the Catholic Worker House in Uptown Chicago, and that's where I spent the rest of my 20s pretty much, till I came to Northampton in 2002 because I was kind of burned out. All right, now we'll go back to some more Chicago clips. So if you heard the first part of the show when I was on the train on the Amtrak coming in, then you heard me talking about the loudspeakers guys that were bad-mouthing the south side of Chicago. This one guy in particular, this white guy, very terrified of the south side of Chicago. So the next part of this clip is sort of a response to being with him and the little conversation I had with him on the train.
Riding through the south side of Chicago, like, where was I? 63rd and Stony Island, no, 63rd and Cottage Grove, I believe. I was looking for the Blacks and Green place. I found it. It kind of feels like a relief to be riding on the south side. Just feels a little less hectic than the north side, but of course, those are two very broad categories. And the north side is very big, and the south side is very big. But riding down Marquette, 67th Street, wow, there's just so much more. I feel like there's much more trees and green space, and like Jamaican restaurants kind of reminded me of Trinidad. I have lots of warm feelings about that. The guy on the train on the Amtrak, that the loudspeaker white guy from Providence that was saying all these racist things about the South Side. I just don't know how to address something like that. I mean, I talked to him personally, but I really just wanted to yell because, like, his energy and his ideas were filling the whole car, and I just wanted to yell to counteract that. Yeah, like, his fear was like what was being broadcast throughout that car. It's Monday, October 3rd, 2022. I'm in Chicago on the south side. What neighborhood is this, Mike?
Market Park on the southwest side.
Yeah, I'm at Mike and Katie's house, and we've been chatting it up. And Mike actually lost his mom in October, a few years ago, too. But we were telling mom stories, Mike. And what was that? Well, yeah, your mom had one of her last goals in life. Can you tell that story?
Yes. Well, my mom was hanging on in her 93rd year, living in the same bungalow that she had lived in for, at that point, 63 years. So she was kind of the old white lady in pretty much an all-Hispanic neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And was very well cared for by her neighbors. Sometimes I would go there to take care of her, and she needed some help, and neighbors would be there. And I said, well, really, thank you for coming over. I couldn't get here for, you know, a half hour or so. And she told me then that, oh, no, they were here for at least 3 hours taking care of me, as if it was nothing. Mm-hmm. I was like, wow, you are in a great place to live for an old white lady. Mm-hmm. So as time went on, my mom needed more and more care, but she never
veered from the thought as she watched CNN and other news channels, because basically that's all she could do to keep in contact with the outside world, was hope that she would live long enough.
Wait, what year is this?
This was in 2020. To vote in the national election in November in 2020. And so she wanted to stay alive so she could vote against Donald Trump. And it didn't really matter who the Democratic was, as long as she could vote Donald Trump and see him get out of office. So as we got closer to the day and her health was failing, she made a point, even in her pain and distress, of saying, would somebody please get me an absentee ballot so that I can vote? And sure enough, we did that. We got her an absentee ballot. And on October 15th, I believe it was 2 weeks before the election, you could mail in your absentee ballot. We got her a ballot, and we showed it to her, and she punched a ticket for Joe Biden, and she signed her name, and she told me, now get that thing in the mail. And then when I came back for the next visit, she said, you did mail it, didn't you? And on October 20th, she finally died, knowing that she voted.
So she was one of those dead voters that Donald Trump was talking about.
Yes, she's one of those dead voters. And we all kind of laughed and thought about the legality, but in Illinois at least, as long as you're alive when you send in your absentee ballot, that's good enough.
Don't be dead when you're sending it in.
It's still good, yeah.
Well, go Moms. Oh, thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
Coming down 63rd Street, headed east towards the lake. It seems like you go through Marquette Park, I don't know, Inglewood, Woodlawn, I'm not sure the neighborhoods. But then when you get to Hyde Park, which is the University of Chicago neighborhood, it seems like the open spaces that used to be grassy areas previously are now suddenly all parking lots. I exaggerated. It was really just one big parking lot that gave me that feeling. That feeling of the whole thing being paved over. Today's Veterans Day, so let me play some Buffy St. Marie.
It's us, right? His orders come from far away no more. They come from him and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put an end to war. So it's about individual responsibility.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan. And he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds. He says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die. And he never sees the writing on the walls. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Dachau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body and war. And without him, all this killing can't go on. He is the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from him and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put an end to war.
You're listening to WXOJLP 103.3 FM in Northampton. Democracy Now! Is coming on in just a minute.
Post 8006 in Florence, and I listen to Valley Free Radio 103.3 FM WXOJLP in Northampton.